Welcome to Chicago Musician. I'm your host, Sean Stengel. Today is the official first day of spring, and it actually feels like it here in Chicago, although cooler by the lake, but not too much. Speaking of spring, our guest today is like a refreshing spring breeze and a warm ray of sunshine. Her name is Renee Matthews, and she's had an over 85-year career as a performer. The lady has stories to tell. Stick around. Welcome to the third episode of Chicago Musician. Today is Monday, March 21st, 2022, the first day of spring. But the world doesn't feel so springy these days. There's a lot of dark clouds hanging over our heads, from the ongoing pandemic to the horrors in Ukraine. And there's a lot that's really unnerving about the times we're living through. And I heard something on the news the other day, and it really got my blood boiling. So I want to get it off my chest a little bit. There was an interview I heard where they were talking about Putin's use of propaganda within Russia and his suppression of the press there, and, you know, his claims that he's doing a special military action in Ukraine and denazifying Ukraine and, you know, all the bullshit he's feeding to the Russians. And the interviewer asked, well, do the Russian people really believe this? To which the expert said, listen, we have 40% of people in this country who still believe the orange guy won the last election. I mean, she didn't say the orange guy, but I do. So we have our own disinformation problem in this country. So yeah, of course the Russians believe it. At least a certain amount of them believe it. That is the nature of the disinformation wars we're facing these days. And that is a huge problem in this country too. I mean, we literally have Fox News promoting the Russian disinformation line. Idiots like Tucker Carlson and, you know, everyone else, down to like Tulsi Gabbard, literally using Russian talking points. It blows my mind that the flag-waving, you know, Republican Party is now so far gone. They've been gone for a while, but that they literally would rather support Putin and authoritarianism and have Biden fail, the president of their own country fail, so they could own the libtards. We are fucked up, people. And it's a real problem. I mean, Fox News to me has poisoned America. We have, you know, they have succeeded in dumbing down at least half of us. You know, even courts have said they're not really news, they're entertainment. Any person in their right mind wouldn't, you know, think of it as news. Well, you know, people from my parents' generation think if it's on TV, it must be true, right? I mean, they wouldn't put it on TV unless it's true. It's like, yeah, maybe Walter Cronkite, but that is not the truth these days. And what is the truth? Well, that is harder to discern, but I'll tell you this, in my opinion. There is one side in this country that is against everything and everyone that is not them. And there is another side that is actually concerned with governing and trying to make our country and our world better and dealing with the reality of what we're dealing with, not denying climate change, but doing something about it. Not trying to prevent dark-skinned people from voting, but making voting easier and safer for everybody. I love that they're like worried about voter fraud, but the only voter fraud from the last election was Republicans voting three times in the villages in Florida, or Mark Meadows, you know, stealing elections in Virginia or Maryland, wherever he was from. It's infuriating. And I guess you can tell I'm like a left-leaning socialist my ass, you know. I'm actually very much in the center. the right has moved so far right, they can't see the center anymore. So, of course, we're all communists and socialists to them. But our country is in real trouble because there is no acceptance of fact as fact anymore. And when that is gone, what is the basis for even a discussion with people? It's troubling. I'm not an expert with all the answers, but I'm worried. I'm worried that we're so divided, and the manipulation of all of us by media and people interested in power, and it's a mess. It's probably the biggest damage the orange turd foisted upon us. It's not like racism and you know, anti-abortion, all the sort of Republican tropes. It's not like they didn't exist before Trump, but somehow he has enabled and empowered people to be the worst version of themselves. Let's get in our semis and disrupt traffic and wave flags and, you know, shut down cities. Yeah, that's admirable. Pisses me off. So, you know, if you keep coming back to Chicago Musician, you're going to hear a few more rants. But they're rants mostly of frustration and bewilderment. I want our country to be a wonderful place. I do think it is a wonderful place. It is still the place that people would love to live in this world. Imagine Ukraine now being bombed to smithereens, and we're watching it in real time. And the solutions to stopping it are so complicated and difficult, and yet we can't even stand up as a country for what's right and agree with, you know, to stand behind freedom and not with authoritarianism. And whew, we've got a mess on our hands. So I went a little dark there on the first day of spring, but don't worry, help is on the way. Our guest today is Renee Matthews, and she is a delight, a bundle of energy. And if she can't solve all the world's problems in the next 30 or 40 minutes, she's going to make us think she did anyhow. She's that compelling. I am so excited to welcome to Chicago Musician the wonderful and lovely Renee Matthews. Renee, welcome.
Thank you for asking me. I'm delighted to be here.
As you should be.
Okay.
We have a lot to cover, but I just want to say you're one of my favorite people and beloved by so many in the Chicago theater community.
Thank you.
And you know us all. I see you at every opening. I see you around and about, and you really, you see a lot of theater.
I try to be present. You know, at this stage of my life, there's not many, if any, parts to be had, so I'm delighted to be an audience and watch all the people that I know and new people that are arriving to be in our Chicago theater community and watch what they're doing.
Yes.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, well, let's just say you've had your fair share of roles.
Yes, I have.
So this is where I want to start. A lady doesn't tell her age, but people like me do. You just turned 90.
Last week.
And passed your driver's test.
And passed my driver's
test. I love this. I offered to come pick you up and bring you here, and you're like, no, I'll drive.
I'll drive. I'll be independent as long as I can.
How's parking in front of your house? I'm like, it's good. Okay. So that's hilarious. But that also means you started performing when you were 4?
Well, actually, 6. I made my debut at the Chicago Theater, doing 5 shows a day for a Christmas review.
And that was like for Queen Elizabeth I?
I don't know.
I think it was 19... 19- Well, 38, I think.
32, 33, 4, 5, 6, 7, 38. 1938 at the Chicago Theater. We did five shows a day in between, of course, the movie that was shown at that time. And it was a whole Christmas review, gorgeous costumes. And I got to sing a solo.
Okay, and did you just like look this up in the trade papers and find an audition and go find yourself a job? How did you get this job?
Well, I was taking dance lessons with Muriel Abbott, who happened to be the queen of ballet lessons in Chicago at that time. And although I was a fairly good dancer, that was not one of my strong points. But she knew that I was a singer. And she was apparently commissioned to do a Christmas show at the Chicago Theater, five shows a day in between the movies. And they put together a glorious children's chorus, children's dancers, gorgeous costumes.
But of course, you weren't chorus.
I wasn't choral. I had a solo calling.
You were featured.
Yeah. I had a solo song. And
do you remember what song it was?
I can't remember the title right now.
That doesn't matter. You have the cutest picture of you from that review. I'm going to post it on our podcast.
Well,
here.
I still have that dress. That's what's so interesting. It was custom made.
Yes, I find it awkward that you're actually wearing it today, but but it's impressive.
It doesn't fit the right way, though.
No, I mean, but it looks, it's a statement.
On just the left arm, that's all it fits.
Kind of crazy, but it's a nice look. Thanks for bringing it. So that was just the beginning.
Yeah.
You also, I mean, you come from lineage of performers.
Well, my father was hailed as another Caruso during the World's Fair of 1933 at Soldier Field. And he was the soloist. And as a matter of fact, Albert Einstein, who came to see the show, came backstage to greet the young man that brought tears to his eyes. So I have a wonderful picture of Albert Einstein and my dad, and that was always a wonderful legacy. My mother was a concert pianist, and so they toured all over the country concertizing. So I certainly had no way out. By the time I was a little kindergarten girl, I was already singing and dancing and so forth. But they never pushed. It was all very naturally done.
You just loved it?
I guess I did.
Well, you were clearly around the luminaries. I mean, Einstein, not that we think of him as a brilliant musician, but...
Right.
Talk about a name of the 20th century.
Right. It's a beautiful heritage. And I'm trying to keep scrapbooks with enough of the publicity that I have because I want my grandchildren to see all of this. I think it would be very interesting someday when they'll appreciate their heritage. But unfortunately, all of them are only interested in sports, the girls too, so they all play basketball, but nobody's interested in music.
Oh,
so maybe their children will pick it up.
Those hideous sports people. I grew up with a lot of sports. I don't think they're mutually exclusive, by the way.
Yeah.
Sometimes it just, arts takes a while for your brain to develop and catch up.
Absolutely.
So that you have an appreciation.
I just want them to be well and happy in what they do and in their education. And I won't be here to see all of the fruits of my labor, but I hope that they'll be good kids and follow what their dreams.
So how many children do you have?
I have two sons.
Okay. And how many grandkids?
And I have six grandchildren.
Okay. Only four that you like or six total?
Six total, I guess I have to say that.
Yes, we can edit in something else later. So I want to hear a little bit more about this Soldier Field performance. It sounds gargantuan.
Well, it must have been. It was during the World's Fair of 1933, and my dad and all the musicians and the conductor and the orchestra were all in sub-basement. They were never seen. Because the pageant took place on the grounds of Soldier Field itself.
Okay, wow.
So they were never seen. But the story that I got was that Albert Einstein was so taken with my father's singing and chanting that he came backstage because he wanted to meet the young man that brought tears to his eyes. And I grew up with that story, so that's always something that I've cherished. And then my father, in addition to the singing, was a professional artist and photographer. So all my growing up years, he had a photographic studio in South Shore, where we lived, all my growing up years. But then on the high holidays, he would always be the cantor at the big synagogue near where we live. So he kept up his singing, you know.
That's wonderful.
But he had to make a living. So.
And your mother, did she also...
My mother was a concert pianist.
Did she play in synagogue at all? Or
no,
is that,
not at all, but she accompanied him on most of his tours. And then she taught piano out of our home. Our home was always filled with students coming and going. And I would be in the kitchen helping to prepare dinner while she was in the living room teaching somebody a scale on the piano.
That's wonderful.
Nice memories.
She died way too young, right? Your mom?
She contacted cancer, which they didn't know what to do, at the age of 56. Hmm. And unfortunately, she just, you know, she went. And there was nothing in those years that they could do for her. And the next tragic thing that happened at that time, my father was crossing the street near our home, and a woman made the wrong turn and plowed into him. So my father was killed by an automobile on California and Devon about a night before I was supposed to open up in Follies at Candlelight, which was my first show.
Oh, wow.
So it it was kind of an ordeal until, and we're not religious. I mean, the rabbi was not part of my life, but we had a nice communication, and I called him and told him what happened, and he said, your father was a performer. You have an obligation to that show to open on opening night, be there for the rest of the cast. You will mourn later on. This is what your father would want you to do.
Yeah, you
to
know,
open up.
See, folks, the show must go on.
The show must go on
is not some bullshit phrase. It truly is.
It was an amazing experience. So I opened up in Follies. That was my first legitimate show. I had concertized all over the country, but I never investigated legitimate theater. And that happened interesting because I was interviewed on a television program called Some of My Best Friends. And apparently Bill Polinsky, who owned Candlelight, must have been watching the show because I got a call from him the next day saying he was interested in seeing me for their production of Follies.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's what started.
That's thrilling. You start with like maybe the best show ever, Sondheim, Follies.
It was gorgeous. Lots of wonderful people in the show. We were treated royally. It was a wonderful place to work. So that was really the beginning of my theater career because I really enjoyed it, and then parts were coming up.
You haven't stopped working since.
And I've been very lucky. I've had a long, involved career, and I can't complain.
And a varied career. You don't just
do
musicals.
Very varied, because I love comedy.
Yeah.
You're
a double Jeff Award winner. The Joseph Jefferson Awards are like the Chicago Tony Awards, theater awards.
Yeah, the Jeff
and
Award.
And Renee has two of them.
I
have zero. So, I actually have a Jeff Citation, so I have half.
Okay.
That's for the non-equity awards.
Okay.
So, 2.5. You're winning. You're
it's
always
nice.
Winning.
You know what? When you work hard at something and you know that you've accomplished something, it's very nice to be rewarded. I'm not diminishing awards. If they're rightfully won and people are honored to be honored,
yeah,
that's wonderful.
I'm not an awards fan, but I also think we celebrate. If you get to win and it's your time, that's great. Because
absolutely.
This is such an unfair
yeah.
business.
Yeah.
And so if you get celebrated,
yeah.
please, let's all join in and celebrate.
Yeah. And especially when you know you've been at this since you've been a little girl and you've worked hard at it and been dedicated to it.
What did you win for?
I won for Old Jews Telling Jokes.
Oh, yeah. Hilarious at the Royal George.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember the joke that you told about the Pope and the hair?
No.
Okay, we're going to edit this because you're going to tell it. It's the one about, you know, someone goes to the Pope and then whatever, and at the punchline is the Pope leans over and say, who fucked up your hair?
Oh, I don't remember.
You don't remember that joke?
There were too many jokes in the show that went on and on and on and on.
That's true. You had like 100 zillion. You guys just cast a five or something. You just kept coming on and telling old,
yeah.
hilarious jokes.
And you know what
jokes.
Was wonderful? As in most shows, you usually end up with a couple of new friends, people that you find feel the way you do. You feel that there's an engagement there with somebody else. But I have to tell you, the group of old Jews telling jokes, they were like, we were like a family that I had never experienced anything like that before. And we've remained friends, you know, through the years. We're in contact. And it was a very remarkable
feeling.
That's
a great group. I mean, you had Tim Kazurinsky.
Oh, Tim, my darling Tim.
Former Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Gene Wigand. Alex Dara. Our friend Lucia was the stage manager.
Lucia was wonderful.
What a group. I hope I didn't leave out somebody. I probably did. But that was a great. And then the performance I remember, I think this was your first Jeff Award, was for the Full Monty.
Oh, my God. With all the bad words I had to say. My, this clean-cut woman.
That's
and
right.
They gave me all of these swear words. I had a ball.
Yeah.
I had a ball because that's my inner self, is being raucous and vulgar.
Yes. That's how everyone thinks of you. No, it's so funny. You're so delightful and classy. And to get to play against type like that.
That's what acting is all about.
It's an actor's dream.
You want to stretch yourself. You want to be something other than you are in real life. That's where the acting comes from. And I got to tell you that I just had a ball with that.
You are so funny. I mean, what's the character? Her name, I think, was Jeanette.
Jeanette.
Like an old rehearsal pianist.
An old rehearsal pianist who was tough and abroad. And
grizzled.
And, oh boy, she told it like it is.
There's some lyric in one of her songs about, you know, how Frank Sinatra broke all her fingers and she still played that night. Yeah, hilarious.
We had fun on stage and off. It was a wonderful cast.
That's the best. The best possible equation if you do live theater. Sometimes, like, shows are fun, but backstage is full
exactly.
of drama or people that just don't get along.
Exactly.
And sometimes it's just work. And sometimes the show is horrible, but...
It's a paycheck.
But the people are wonderful.
Yeah, exactly.
Which brings me to a great segue. When I first worked with you, we did what I consider one of the most hideous shows I've ever done, and probably you loved it, Broadway Bubbies, that we did at the Briar Street, where Blue Man Group now has
right,
been
the
ensconced
Briar Street
for like,
Theater, right. And Edie Adams, may she rest in peace, I think she recently passed away, she was brought in to be the star.
Yeah, unfortunately, our writer, conceiver, director, producer, like conceived and produced, but didn't know how to direct and really didn't write a show. So we had all these talented ladies.
All the talented gals.
Without much to do. So
right.
We made up a show.
Right.
I mean, I remember, God bless you, Renee, you did a medley that included going from Hava Nagila to Ball in the Jack.
Oh, I did.
And somehow you pulled it off.
I don't remember.
Hilarious. Edie Adams, for those of you that don't remember, she was a Tony winner. Initially, she was Daisy May in the original Little Abner on Broadway, but then she married Ernie Kovacs.
Right.
And she was famously the legs of the Muriel cigar commercials.
Yes.
And unfortunately, by the time she got to us, she had very little.
She was broken.
Yeah, she had very little to fall back on.
And we often talked that the mistake was, instead of putting her in as an actress singer, she should have just talked about her life in the theater, her life with Ernie Kovacs, the auditions, what she went through, where she was hired, where she wasn't hired. Yeah. That would have been a wonderful theatrical story, but they put her up as a performer, and she was playing
a character that wasn't really
hurt. Wasn't
You're
developed.
Right. Her own story was
yeah,
so much
her
better.
Her own story. We used to be just glued to her backstage when she talked about her life.
She was a lovely lady.
A lovely lady.
And you're right, kind of lost by the time she got to us, but she couldn't have been nicer. And my favorite thing is she taught all you ladies how to smile for pictures. It was like you would go like 1, 2, 3, pop, and you'd have to open your mouth slightly. and so we took all these pictures of
oh,
with the
my
perfect
Lord.
Smiles.
Oh, my Lord.
Again, but to my point, I thought a horrible show. We ran about 3 weeks longer than we ever should have. But backstage, was like such
was glorious. And all the stories that she used to tell us backstage would have made the show.
Exactly.
But that would have made the show. People would have been hungry to find out how she started, Ernie Kovacs, her life, where she went, where she auditioned, what she did. And instead they put her up as a singer, straight actress, which was devastating.
Yeah.
It wasn't her forte.
Her coloratura voice was long gone.
Of absolutely.
So.
Absolutely.
Another funnier memory I have of you was at the Goodman. I got to assist, kind of, direct.
Christmas Carol. Mrs. Fezziwig.
The first year at the new Goodman, which is what, 20 years old now?
Oh boy, I don't know, yeah.
But the very first time in the new theater, getting to be on a new set and a new everything. And I remember, I didn't know you well at that time, but you were Mrs. Fezziwig. But what made me laugh so much was, you were also like a grave digger or a grave robber.
I may have had a secondary, something they had to fill in.
With Bill Norris or something?
Yeah, Bill Norris.
God bless him. He recently passed.
I found out that too. I was just devastated.
What a character.
Devastated. And
he was Scrooge for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
And then in this incarnation, he was like the schoolmaster and with you, a grave robber.
You
were hilarious.
I had a ball.
And heartwarming as Mrs. Fezziwig.
I'll never forget, we were all standing on stage in some kind of a choral thing, and one of the actors was on a movable, somebody inside the box was, of course, moving it. One of the characters was supposed to move around, and the man in the box that was doing the moving part of it evidently fell asleep. And that started to go right toward the orchestra pit.
Oh, my.
It was just traveling right to the orchestra pit, and we saw it. We saw it happening, and one of the actors just broke right away from our where we were standing in place and went over and caught the machine to stop the actor from being thrown into the orchestra pit.
Doesn't sound like much of a machine if there was a guy inside the box moving it.
Yeah, moving it, yeah.
The magic of theater.
Yeah. So there's so much going on that an audience is never aware of. Unless you're an actor, you know the things that go on backstage and on the set. Sometimes it's more dramatic than the show itself.
Oh, of course. Much of the time. It's an illusion. We work really hard to make it seem magical.
Real. Right.
Well, we're going to take a little break.
Okay.
But when we come back, I'm going to ask you about some of your other favorite roles.
Good.
And shows that you've really enjoyed doing, plus a little bit more about your life outside the theater. We'll be right back after the interval. Today's interval was brought to you by our regular sponsor, Nobody. Of course, Renee, you sang a perfect fourth. What else would an angel sing?
Oh, thank you so much.
You sound like in beautiful voice still.
Well, I've never abused it, so I guess it can stay with you as long as you still got the strength.
Is it true you studied at the Met?
Yes, I did. My father was a part-time cantor at one of the Northside synagogues. That was besides his regular career as being a portrait photographer with a beautiful studio. And
So how did you get to Richard Tucker?
Well, Tucker came to Chicago to conduct high holiday services at one of the synagogues, and my father was the head of the choir. And during all the rehearsal period and getting together, I guess they talked about family. And my dad told him about my career and what I do and what I am and so forth. And so he arranged a meeting. We met for lunch. And he said that he would like to refer me to his coach at the Metropolitan Opera in New York after I finished singing for him. He said, would that be possible? And I said, absolutely, that would be the chance of a lifetime.
So you moved to New York?
I moved to New York for a summer. It was just a summer. I couldn't go for, you know, an extended length of time. But I did go for about 4 months, and I studied at the Met with Richard Tucker's coach at the Met. And I came home with a great deal of education and learning and improvement. Not that I wanted to follow in a classical career. I was always happier in the more modern kind of pop comedy.
So you said you toured all over the country with an accompanist.
I did. I had a one-woman show, and from opera to pop, and we toured really all over the United States for colleges, universities, organizations, private parties, fundraising affairs.
So this is mostly what you did before you started doing theater. But
yes.
But I know you also did it while you've been doing theater. When I first met you, you were still touring, and you would go to a social and perform for the ladies.
Exactly. I had a wonderful touring career. It was all over the United States, and I had a remarkable partner, pianist, who has since passed on, who basically was a wonderful actor. So we used to do a lot of scenes from musicals in which we could perform and still do something with a little bit of story to it. So it was very successful.
I can't relate to that at all. A piano player with acting skills?
Oh, yes.
My, unheard of.
Yes, he was quite the character. Unfortunately, we lost him a few years ago, but he was a wildly talented man, and we were very successful in what we did because we were able to do scenes from musicals, which brought theater to the people, including a concert at the same time.
Right. What was his name?
Jerry Preskill.
Okay, excellent.
Jerry Preskill.
And then you had another life even beside that. You're a classical harp player.
Yes, I've played the harp since I was a teenager. My father always loved that instrument. It accompanied him on a number of his concert tours. And he said when I was the right age, he wanted me to start the harp. So I started the harp. I guess I was a teenager. And this is the best story of all. I played the harp all my growing up years in concerts and private for my own pleasure. And one day, I get a call from a young man who introduced himself to me, and he said that he worked at Northwestern Hospital with a young woman who had been on the bus with me when I used to go out to Great Lakes and entertain all the boys in the various hospital rooms. And when she heard I was a harpist, she said, I work with a harpist at Northwestern. He's a social worker. Can I give him your number? I said, absolutely. So this young man called, and he said, I understand you play the harp. And I said, yes, I do. He said, well, I'm a harpist by hobby. He said, I have no desire to be a professional harpist, but I'm a social worker, and we made a date. That turned out to be my future husband, in which we had two harps in our house all of our lives. And when I stopped playing the harp and sold it, my husband, up until the day he passed away, which is 6 years ago, played the harp every single night because that was his outlet. That was his greatest pleasure. He never had any intention of playing for anybody, but that was his hobby. And we had, up until recently, his harp in the house until I sold it to a young boy of 16 who plays the harp in his high school orchestra, and they bought Shell's harp. And I was never so happy to give it to somebody like that in my life.
Shell, your husband, lovely man.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
I love
the picture of the two of you with two harps in your apartment.
With two harps in the house. Can you imagine? Nobody believes the story.
It was like a heavenly preview.
Nobody believes that.
One of my regrets in my career is I was going to direct you up at Peninsula Players in a show called Radio Gals. And then you had committed to doing it, and then Shell got sick with, I think, kidney disease or something.
It was cancer, yeah.
Yeah, and you had to withdraw. And I've always regretted that because you would have been a knockout in, like you are in everything
Thank
you do.
Thank you. Well, we can't predict, can we? There are so many things that we can control. But so much, and I'm an old lady already, so much that you know you can't control and you have to roll with the punches. You either accept it and adjust yourself, or you fall on the wayside. What can you do?
Yeah, and your family's more important than a show.
Absolutely.
They're as important as we make our careers.
Absolutely. I've always been thrilled to get a role and be successful and get a nice write-up, but family has got to come first. That's your first obligation.
I know you have another very cool harp happening. Somehow you were in Southern California.
Oh, yes.
How did, you know what I'm talking about.
Of course.
But our listeners don't, so let's fill them in.
Well, this is really, I forgot, and I was hoping we would bring it up, and then I forgot, so I'm glad you reminded me. I was going out to California to study voice, here I go again, with Mario Lanza's coach at MGM. I can't even recall how I got to that, but I was supposed to go out there and study with him for a couple of months. And my harp teacher said, well, if you're going to California, I'm going to set up a meeting with Harpo Marx because I know him and the family. I said, oh, my God, you know, that would be wonderful. So to make a long story short, I cabbed to Harpo's home up in Beverly Hills. Groucho was there, and a couple of the kids were there, and Harpo and his wife, beautiful home. And we had lunch, and then he said to me, you know, you see those two big harps in the bay window of that living room? He said, I want you to play something for me. Lovely, lovely, lovely man. He was the best of all the brothers, down to earth and intelligent and refined and kind. The others had screws loose, I think, somewhere in the brain.
Did he play?
So I sat down and I played Liebestraum, which was the one thing that I could do best of all. And I said, but you promised me you would play. He said, you know, I've always just kind of improvised. You know, I play all these big glissandos going up and down and a couple of chords. He said, but I'm studying now because I think it's about time I learned how to really play a song. I don't remember what he played, but he sat down and he played a little ditty for me. And it was the loveliest afternoon in my memory, only in my memory because unfortunately at that time there were no hand recorders. There was no, you know, I couldn't come with something that could record this.
No one took a picture on their cell phone.
Nobody took a picture on this. But I'll tell you something interesting. A friend of mine conducts lectures in California. Kari Howard. You remember Kari.
Yep.
Kari moved to California with her family, and she conducts lectures on different subjects at a local a community center, and she engaged Harpo's son, who plays in Las Vegas. It's quite a while. I don't know if he's still there. Engaged him to come and talk about his father, his career, and Harpo's career. When the lecture was over, she told him about my relationship with Harpo. So he took his book on his family that has just been published, and he inscribed it to Renee and Harpo from me, from him. And the book is wonderful. It's a whole biography of his family. He and his sister were adopted. Harpo and his wife couldn't have any children. And they often wondered where his musicianship came from. He's a remarkable musician and composer. So he told me that one day Harpo, his mother and dad, decided to go back to the orphanage where he and his sister were adopted from. And they found out that his real mother, who abandoned him, had been a concert pianist. So, I get goose pimples telling you the story. Yeah. He said, so I finally found out where my musical heritage came from. He said, but Harpo, my mom and dad, he said, they were two of the greatest people in the world. And he's still playing, I think, in Las Vegas. He has a music stint in Las Vegas.
That's wonderful story, wonderful memories.
Wonderful memories.
I mean, who knows the Marx Brothers?
That's
well,
right.
Renee Matthews, friends.
Yeah. Isn't that incredible?
That's so wonderful.
Thank you for bringing it up. I haven't thought about that in a long time.
I remember the first time you told that to me, it stuck in my brain forever. I'm like, the picture of you playing for Harpo Marx in his own house in the
right
picture window in the living room. It's fantastic. I said before the break we were going to talk about some of your favorite other roles that you've gotten to do in theater. And I know at least one of them was Over the River and Through the Woods.
Over the River and Through the Woods was one of the last shows I did, and we were so successful. out in
Munster, weren't you?
In the South Side, that they moved us to the Mercury.
Oh, here on Southport.
And we came back to the Mercury, and we had a long run there. But
that was quite a nice group of
it
actors
was the most,
as well, right?
The most wonderful group of people. We've lost a couple of them in between, but it was memories that I think I'll cherish for the rest of my life. We were so loved by the audiences, and the feeling among all of us was like we became brothers and sisters backstage. It's one of my wonderful memories, and of course I did Follies at Candlelight, and then I did Bye Bye Birdie there, which was a joy. With That's, Dale Benson, my darling Dale Benson. I got to tell you, the day I came to the first audition, the first rehearsal for Bye Bye Birdie, Dale came up to me and he said, I have to tell you, he said, I'm a couple of years older than you are, but I remember you, Renee, from High Park High School when you used to play the harp at all of the affairs in the auditorium with your blonde curls.
We never forgot that. Dale is an institution in our
Dale
theater.
Is the dearest man that God ever put on this earth, and a wonderful actor. A wonderful actor besides. Yeah. And then I did Grease and 70 Girls 70.
I think another show that you've slid by a few times. What's that one? There's a Fiddler, a Roof.
Oh, Fiddler on the Roof, which I've done 102 times.
Right.
And I always play Yenta the Matchmaker.
Of course you
That's
do.
That's my part.
But talk about a treasure of a show and a role to get to
and
do.
And it never gets tired. Audiences love it. The younger generations get to hear a little bit about what went on at that time.
I use Fiddler on a Roof. Fiddler on the Roof. As an example, when people say like, oh, an audience can't relate to that subject matter. Oh, people will never get that story. They don't know anything. I'm like, listen, I'm not a Russian Jew
right.
at the turn of the last century.
Right.
And yet I find Fiddler on the Roof moving and pertinent to my life story.
It speaks to every family. Nobody gets out of this without tragedy, without good times, and without bad times.
And conflict. My mother played Golda in the Brainerd, Minnesota, all Lutheran cast version of Fiddler
really?
On the Roof.
Really? Really?
And I'm sure one of the highlights of her performing life, because you're in this show, bad or good or horrible or wonderful, no matter what it is, it works. It works.
It works because every religious group, every national group has all gone through something like this in years gone by.
Some version
Nobody
of it.
came to this country with love and laughter and money and position. Everybody came from people that struggled to make our lives
better.
Right.
Right.
Everybody's got a history.
Yeah. So it's.
And then let's see. I did Queen of the Stardust Ballroom, which I got a chance to. Ballroom dance, which was wonderful.
They should have you on Dancing with the Stars.
Oh yeah, my two left feet now.
That's right. Well, you might get some pity votes.
Yeah,
or something.
right. And of course, Over the River and Through the Woods. That's when we moved to Chicago. Greece. I was the school teacher in Greece.
Mrs. Lynch, is that? I think that's the character's name.
Yeah, I think
name.
So. That was at Marriott also.
So you've just done a wonderful variety of roles.
Wonderful, you know.
And considering that you didn't start in theater till you were 50.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a wonderful resume on its own, let alone your harp career and your singing career.
Yeah, I have no complaints. Just right now at this stage of the game, as we get older, you realize that if you have your health, then the sky is the limit. And yep. I've had wonderful memories, a wonderful career, healthy, happy children. So I have nothing to complain about. But every day when I wake up, if I say I can make myself breakfast and I can get in my car. I passed my driver's test last week.
Exactly.
And I get in my car and I can go any place I want to go and not have to ask anybody for anything. That's the greatest gift of all. And wonderful memories.
Yeah.
Wonderful scrapbooks full of beautiful pictures and programs and friends and people that I've met through the years. I'm not looking for anything more than just to stay in relatively good health and independent and be able to make a meal.
Well,
I love cooking. I was always a good cook.
I've had your cooking. It's wonderful.
I always love
cooking. Yeah, I find it, you know, that you've come through this life with wonderful memories, but it's not like you haven't had some hard knocks.
A lot of tragedy.
And yet you are the most positive person I know.
Thank you.
And still have this, you know, get up and greet the day kind of attitude that is...
And you know, you can't learn that. I'm very grateful. I have to tell you, I'm very grateful that that's part of my personality through no fault of my own. But it's a terrible thing to go through life always looking at what's wrong.
Yes.
What's terrible, what might be, what couldn't be.
Right.
It's a terrible, I think that it makes you unhealthy. I think you're prone to getting sick from that kind of thought.
Yeah.
It's nothing that was taught to me. It was something that just was in me from being a young child. It was in me.
I think you can choose to try to be happy, but there are people who are just, it's not in their nature.
They're just down, and they can't help themselves.
Not necessarily. So I just find you remarkable on that level.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, right now, I guess it's what's keeping me alive, plus the fact that I can still drive.
Yeah.
That, I got to tell you, that's the greatest gift in the world. And I didn't start driving until after I was married, and my husband never drove a car.
Really?
So I was the chief chauffeur for many, many, many years until I said, you know what? You've got to get behind the wheel because I can't do this anymore.
Well, you're still the chauffeur for some of your friends.
Yeah.
For some of the young chicks.
Yeah, the young chicks. Right.
Well, Renee, it has been such a pleasure.
It's been so wonderful to reminisce because you don't do this on your own at home when you're alone.
Oh, I do.
I mean, I go through my scrapbooks, but just to talk about it now, it brings a lot of this to life again.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you asking me to share these stories
with you. Well, they're wonderful stories and definitely deserve to be shared with a wider audience. So now, all six of my podcast listeners will know all your stories.
Oh my God, there's no getting away from all the private life I have talked about.
That's right. So I want to thank Renee Matthews for being a wonderful guest, and I hope you'll check back again with us on Chicago Musician. I'm your host, Sean Stengel. So good.
Wow.
What a delight. You're a natural, obviously.
I hope it came across okay.
Oh, okay is an understatement.